Let's think about this just for a moment. Let's see if we can draw something out of this. Israel doing this. Moses gives the instructions, and so Moses then has to tell the nation of Israel. All right. The New Testament certainly harmonizes in all this. And I'm looking at question 13. I ask you to think about the New Testament teaching on several different points that harmonizes really well with what's being taught here about the Hebrews. Hope you had some of these verses. Maybe you had some others that we can think about together. How was Jesus described by John the Immerser or John the Baptizer in John chapter 1, verse 29? Behold, the Lamb of God, which takes away the sin of the world. All right, He was the Lamb. What did Paul say about Jesus in 1 Corinthians 5 and verse 7? He is our Passover. Now, in that chapter, he's talking about church discipline, getting rid of that unruly brother who was sleeping with his father's wife, committing fornication with her, and the church had done nothing. Paul said, rather, you should mourn this activity, but rather you're puffed up about it. And so Paul had to rebuke the church for their failure to act in that way, but also in what to do with the unruly brother. And he says, clean out the old leaven that you may be a new lump, that is unleavened from sin, for Christ is our Passover. Now there's a clear distinction, or rather a clear connection that's being made with the idea of the Passover idea from the law, from the book of Exodus, and this idea about Christ being our Passover feast, if you will. Now let's look in Romans 3, and these are very familiar verses, Romans 3, 23 through 25. Let's read those together. And these verses aren't saying anything that you haven't already heard before, but I just want us to think about these together in view of this bigger picture we're trying to remind ourselves about when it comes to our own redemption. Reading this story back here in Exodus 3 doesn't do a thing for us. We weren't there that day, other than it helps build our own faith and make us think about our own redemption. That's the whole idea of going through these very familiar Old Testament stories. They're supposed to be faith builders and see how much they trust and believe God, so do we. Kevin, would you read for us, please, Romans 3, 23 through 26. 23 through 26. Okay. Look particularly at these points. Of course, number one, verse 23, the off-quoted verse, what's our condition? Well, we're guilty of sin. All have sinned. And we're in need of the blood. Now, verse 24. We've been justified as a gift by His grace through what? Through redemption. Just like Israel had to be redeemed from bondage, we need redemption. Now verse 25, whom God, that is Christ, was displayed publicly as a propitiation in His blood. So blood is involved in our redemption also. So a lot of the same similar points. We're trying to parallel what happened to Israel versus what happens to us and our need for salvation. All right. What does Jesus say about sin in John 8, verse 34? He who commits sin is a slave to sin. See, we're in bondage. Ephesians 1 and verse 7, 1 John 1 and verse 7, those two passages together, teaches us that we have redemption through His blood. So we're blood-bought people. We are blood-redeemed people. Just like Israel, they were blood-redeemed people. The blood of the Lamb had to be applied, and so it is for us also. Colossians 1 verse 14 talks about redemption also. And then Jesus talks about this is the new covenant in my blood, which is shed for many for the remission of sins. Matthew 26 and verse 28. On and on we could go, but we get the idea of how the New Testament also emphasizes this redemptive theme, if you will. Can there be redemption without blood? Not at all. In fact, the Hebrew writer says, without the shedding of blood, there is no forgiveness of sins. Has to be there. So Israel was going to be redeemed on this occasion, and each family had to pick the lamb. In fact, how was the lamb described in the Exodus record? Perfect. That's right. No blemish, no fault, no defect at all. What about our lamb? Tempted in all points as we are, yet without sin. No defect, no blemish whatsoever. So the points just keep lining up, parallel all the way down the line here. Okay. Let's forge ahead here. The only thing to avert the judgment of God was the blood of the Lamb. Now that was the difference maker. Forget for the moment of what was going to happen in Egypt, because those Egyptian houses all throughout the land, they were going to suffer. They weren't in covenant with Jehovah. But when it came to a Hebrew house, all right, the difference maker was the blood. The blood had to be there. So that's true of Old Testament Hebrews in Egypt. What about you and I today? What's the only way we're going to avert or to avoid the judgment of God? It's the blood of the Lamb. If you don't have the blood of the Lamb applied to your soul, then you're going to suffer judgment. You're going to suffer death and destruction. And on that night, what kind of death was it? Well, it was physical death. What about this death here in the New Testament? It's eternal. It's spiritual death. So it's far worse fate than what they suffered there in Egypt. So again, we see the parallel that's being made. I don't think one can go back and read this story and not think about his own redemption in Christ. It's just too easy to see the parallels, not to think about that. Something for us to obviously consider. Okay, now let's jump the 13th chapter, and let's look at some things in the 14th chapter. Not that the 13th chapter is not important; it is certainly, but we want to tie this story up here, conclude it by thinking about these things and looking at some other points I want us to think about. Israel has left. They've been ordered out of the nation, if you will. And eventually, verses 5 through 9, Pharaoh and all his court of advisors, his wise men and so forth, what conclusion do they come to? What do they say? All our help is gone. We've let the slaves go. I kind of get the idea they say, what in the world have we done here? I mean, yes, they wanted him to go to stop the plague of death. But once that had subsided, and maybe after they had buried all their loved ones, and they're just kind of standing around wondering what they're going to do, and they said, well, we let the slaves go. Well, what in the world were we thinking? I kind of get that idea looking in the fifth verse. What is this we have done that we have let Israel go from serving us? Well, the only one thing to do, let's just go chase them down. So Pharaoh orders the chariots to go. He took how many men with him? 600 select chariots. And all the other chariots of Egypt with officers over all of them. So the army's been dispensed to go bring these people back. Again, you see the phrase in verse 8 that we've talked about so far. What about his heart? It says the Lord hardened his heart again, so he's still in opposition to He's an antagonist to the will of God. His heart is still hard. And he chased after the sons of Israel as the sons of Israel were going out boldly. And so where did they catch up with them? Right in front of the sea. Here's Israel. This nation is, they can't travel very fast. This army's on horses and on chariots. So they can overtake them, and they do. And they do come upon them. So, remember, now earlier, Egypt had begged them to leave because of the death and the destruction. Now they've got a change of heart. And they say, we've got to get the slave labor back. We can't do this without them. Let's bring them back and enslave them. So they chase them, and they do come upon them, and they do overtake them. Well, how did Israel react to this? And to me, this is one of the most dumbfounding parts of this story. Craig, what do they say, basically? They get kind of sassy with Moses, don't they? What is the thing that they say? What's the matter, Moses? Were there not enough graves in Egypt that you've got to bring us out here only to have this army come upon us and just slaughter us out here in the middle of nowhere? Is that what the problem was? Well, had Israel shown some faith in Moses prior to this? Well, they did. And what all had Moses done for them? Had he done anything wrong by them? He brought them out of redemption. He redeemed them, brought them out of slavery. And now the first sign of trouble, okay, we've kind of painted this picture in the past. Of course, they're headed south. They get to the water, so the water's in front of them. What's to the east and the west of them? Well, just barren land, no place to hide. And what's to the north of them? Here come the Egyptians. So, you know they felt trapped. We're just surrounded. We've got no place to hide, no place to go. Woe is us. We're just going to have this great big giant pity party here now. And so they just kind of turn it on Moses and say, Moses, this is verse 11. Is it because there were no graves in Egypt that you have taken us away to die in the wilderness? Why have you dealt with us in this way? Then verse 12, they said what? We told you back there, if you just had left well enough alone, if you had not bothered anything or bothered us, we could have gone on serving the Egyptians. Well, when they were in bondage, what did Israel do? Yeah, they cried to God. What was that a sign of? That's a sign of faith. They had spent 400 plus years in bondage. And they kept crying out to God and pleading for His deliverance and His mercy and His power to redeem them. And as He finally does, He sends Moses. And now they're free. They're not slaves anymore. They come to the very first obstacle. Not long after coming out. And what do? They now claim that they prefer slavery over their freedom. That's not faith. That's fear. And that's the very opposite of faith. So, as we've been saying, is redemption going to come easy? It's not going to come easy. It didn't come easy for them. What about for me and for you? Well, we don't have an army chasing us of men and chariots and whatnot, but we do have an opponent, don't we? We have an adversary. And he's not going to let you go easy, is he? He's not. He's going to always be looking for ways to get us. And one thing we could do, we could kind of respond like Israel did here and say, if we just left well enough alone, if I was okay the way I was back there, well, maybe you weren't going to die. You would be able, of course, they thought they were just going to get slaughtered right then and there, so they're thinking, well, at least you'd be alive. Yeah, but where would you be? You'd be in slavery. And there's no life. There's no freedom in slavery. We want to be free. And here we see just the two main responses. It's either faith or it's fear. I don't know of a third one in between, but they respond in typical human fashion, if you will. Well, okay, that's Pharaoh's response. That's Israel's reaction. What does Moses do? I've asked the question here. This is the last part of question 14. How did Moses try to settle them down? Yeah, look what he says. Chapter 14, verse 13. He says, first thing he says is what? Don't be afraid. All right, there we go. Now, the first thing is don't be afraid. Someone says, yeah, Moses, that's easy for you to say. Well, but he's in there with them. I mean, it's not like he's safe if the Egyptians come and want to run him through. He'll suffer with them too. Don't be afraid. Stand by and see the salvation of the Lord. Moses didn't doubt at all. He had no doubts about this whatsoever. In fact, he even gets more specific. See the salvation of the Lord, which He will accomplish for you today, for the Egyptians whom you have seen today, and they're breathing down our necks, but what did He say? You're not going to see them anymore. They're going to be taken out. Now, isn't that ironic? They've come down here and you think they're going to take us out. And I'm telling you, God's going to take them out. They're the enemy. They're the opponent, and God will defeat them. So you just need to have trust in God. And there's the lesson for us too. When we have such moments like this, that is not the time to get weak-kneed and to become cowardly. But either we trust God like we say we do or we don't. I mean, we do what we claim we do, and we are who we claim to be, or we're not. It's one or the other. And faith really isn't faith till it's been tested. It's going to have to be tested. And Israel's got to pass this test right here. They're going to rely on their leader, Moses. So he reassures them, pointed them to the salvation of the Lord. He reminds them, the Lord's going to fight for you. He wouldn't have brought you all the way out of bondage, clear down here, just to sit back and watch these heathen and these pagans just butcher you up and slaughter you like cattle. No, He's going to fight for you. He loves you too much to abandon you now. And how God used Moses to save Israel, and not just save Israel, but to destroy the enemy, is one of the greatest of all the biblical miracles. And that is the crossing of the Red Sea, which will happen in these next few verses. So I've got a map here, and that's not too dark for you to see. Up there, that would be the Nile Delta. So down here, I've put a little mountain there. That's the Sinai Peninsula right there. Now, these are the places that they've come. There's Ramses. They left Ramses, came to Succoth. These are just the approximate places. From there, the Bible gives these places of points of travel. Etham. Then they circle back. God said, now circle back or turn back away from Etham to Pi-Hahiroth. Someone would say, well, why would God say to do that? They're going south this way. Why come back? It seems like they've turned around. Someone would say, maybe that would give Pharaoh the impression that they're just out there wandering and they're lost and they're aimless. They don't know what they're doing, just kind of roam around like animals. So they go back to Pi-Hahiroth, and then the last place mentioned there is Baal Zephon. And you'll see that there. We see that place listed for us, chapter 14 and verse 2. They came to Pi-Hahiroth between Migdol and the sea. You shall camp in front of Baal Zephon, opposite by the sea. So that's where they come to. So from Egypt they'll come south and then turn back a little bit, and then they're going to cross the Red Sea, it seems, somewhere right in there. We don't know the exact place to cross. Or where they crossed. It certainly wasn't down here in the main part of the Red Sea, but in the Gulf of Suez. We know it was not just crossing a creek. How do we know that? Well, you can't drown an army in a creek. I mean, it was deep enough water to drown an entire army with their horses and their chariots and all that business. So, somewhere it appears that's where they crossed the Red Sea, in the Gulf of Suez. Now, I want to talk just for a few minutes, and I find this interesting. I hope you find this interesting too. I'm not trying to make any more out of this, but it's just something to think about. Think about the logistics of this nation crossing the sea. I came across an article years ago when I was putting out a weekly bulletin in another work where we were, and I found it worthy to include in the bulletin. The Quartermaster Corps of the U.S. Army, they're responsible for, and this has nothing to do with Egypt's redemption. I'm just setting the stage here for the points that were made. Of course, they're responsible for the logistics and the shipment and supply and moving armies about. I mean, that's the business they're in. And so that's sort of what we're talking about here, moving a nation from one place to another. And the Quartermaster General, I don't know who he was at the time that I found this article, but he must have been familiar with the Bible story. He read it. And he thought about what would it take to move Israel through the Red Sea? I think that's interesting to think about. Look at, here's some statistics that he came with. Now, we know in verse 21, look in chapter 14, verse 21. In fact, let's read not just verse 21. The chart should say 21 through 27. Let's read that right quickly together. Exodus 14, verse 21. Then Moses stretched out his hand over the sea, and the Lord swept the sea back by a strong east wind all night, and turned the sea into dry land, so that the waters were divided. And the sons of Israel went through the midst of the sea on the dry land, and the waters were like a wall to them on their right hand and on their left. The Egyptians took up the pursuit. All of Pharaoh's horses, his chariots, and his horsemen went in after them into the midst of the sea. And it came about at the morning watch that the Lord looked down on the army of the Egyptians through the pillar of fire, the cloud, and brought the army of the Egyptians into confusion. He caused their chariot wheels to swerve, and he made them drive with difficulty. So the Egyptians said, "Let us flee from Israel, for the Lord is fighting for them against the Egyptians." Then the Lord said to Moses, "Stretch out your hand over the sea so that the waters may come back over the Egyptians, over their chariots and their horsemen." So Moses stretched out his hand over the sea, and the sea returned to its normal state at daybreak. While the Egyptians were fleeing right into it, then the Lord overthrew the Egyptians in the midst of the sea. When did they cross the Red Sea? It appears at night. Someone asked, how long did it take? Well, that's what we're trying to consider here. We can't come up with a definite answer, but I want you to look at the way God's providing. I'm convinced they crossed in one night, because by the next, whatever time in verse 24, the morning watch, whatever time that is, it's early on. I know it's before daybreak, because daybreak doesn't happen until verse 27, when the water was brought back to its normal state from being its divided walls. All right, but by daybreak the next morning, they've gotten through the channel there, through the path, and the Lord says, "All right, Moses, bring the waters back, and we'll destroy the army." Now, how many people are we talking about? Well, this is a conservative guess. At least 2 to 3 million. Why would I say that? Turn back to chapter 12. Look at verse 37. When they came out of Egypt. We don't have a number for the entire nation, but we do have one piece of information. What are we told in 12:37? Men. 600 and what? 50,000? 600,000 men on foot. That's the marching men. It says, aside from children. Women aren't also mentioned. Now, just thinking for a moment, how big were families back then? They had lots of children. So you're talking a lot of people. All right? Plus, what had they done to Egypt? They plundered Egypt. You reckon they've got some animals and some wagons and some carts and whatever to haul all this stuff? I mean, they're not going to move very fast. This is a big group of people. It's a lot of people. So how fast can they move through the Red Sea? Well, it depends on how wide the swath is there. This is what this quartermaster general determined. And again, he's in the business of planning such activities for an army. So he would know more about it than I do. I'm not going to put too much stock in this, but I think it's worth to consider. He says if they follow a narrow path that's just double file, the line would be 800 miles long and take 35 days and nights to get through. Imagine that. Shoulder to shoulder, just two people at a time. Or what if you just traveled by your own little family, like 10, 12 people, whatever. That's a lot of people to get moved through. But they got through in one night. So I wonder how wide that path was. He determined this. There had to be a space in the Red Sea 3 miles wide. And they would walk about 5,000 abreast. And they can make it through in one night. So when you watch Charlton Heston and the Ten Commandments on television, you got this little bitty kind of a pathway. No, that's not how it happened. It would be very possible for some, if it was that wide, or maybe it was even wider than that, but you could very likely, possibly, be in the middle of the group and not even see the walls of water. And if you were on the end of that, you would be going by one of the, or either of the walls. But that's how much God provided for them. He took care of them so that they could escape this onslaught by the enemy. Notice also, you'll see there again in verse 24, at the morning watch that the Lord looked down on the army through the pillar of fire and the cloud, and He caused them to go into disarray and to mass confusion. It was buying Israel some time to make their escape, which they did. And also, we'll state the obvious again, they went through on what kind of land? It wasn't mud. I mean, you take water away from a seabed or riverbed, it's going to be muddy. But not here. It was dry land. Again, miracle. All under the providing hand of Jehovah. So I thought these points were somewhat interesting. Let us see. God was in complete control. His hand was all in this operation, if you will, for the sole purpose of redeeming His people, and not just redeeming them, but overthrowing the enemy, destroying the enemy. And that's what He'll do to me and you today. Now, we're not fleeing a nation of Egyptians or anybody else, but God seeks to redeem you from slavery too. And He wants to destroy your enemy. But to do that, when they cried to Moses, or they complained to Moses, Moses said, "Now be quiet, let's get out of here." Which way did Moses point? "We're going to go that way. That's where the water is." "Yeah, that's where we're going to go." See, we've got to have trust in God. So you and I need to trust God. Even when it seems like it's the logical thing to do, let God take care of His business. And we can certainly follow Him and rely on Him, and He'll bring us through just as well. Yes, sir. That's right. Complete faith and trust. Yes. All right. Anything else, anybody? Yes, buddy. It wasn't just little old path. There's just no way that would have worked. It had to be something spectacular like this. Now, I'm not going to say that's gospel truth. That's just one man's opinion, but that's at least something to mentally chew on. So this is just another example of the provisions from a mighty God. He took care of His people, then He'll take care of us also in our redemption. Yes, they knew the hand of God was in all this, and they said, "We've got to get out of here." He's fighting against us and for them, and we cannot win on this. Okay. Well, now let's turn to 1 Corinthians 10. This is question number 15. There's another reference to this. 1 Corinthians chapter 10. Listen to what the Apostle Paul says. "I do not want you to be unaware, brethren, that our fathers were all under the cloud and all passed through the sea, and all were baptized into Moses in the cloud and in the sea. And all ate the same spiritual food, and all drank the same spiritual drink, for they were drinking from a spiritual rock which followed them, and the rock was Christ." There's other things mentioned here that are referenced besides just the Red Sea crossing, but we're going to focus only on since that's our story here. Paul refers to this episode to teach us about not following Israel's mistakes, at least in the first 11 verses of this chapter, especially when you come to verse 5 and following. You'll see all these references. Don't let us do this as some of them did and they suffered. Don't do this as they did. So you need to learn from Israel's mistakes. Learn from Israel's history, her past, and not be guilty of committing the same sins that they committed. But before he starts mentioning those, he talks about, at least in verse 2, he says that all Israel was baptized into Moses. Well, obviously, how was the Red Sea crossing a baptism? All right, it was told us, yes, baptism is not sprinkling. We're not trying to get too far off base here and start talking about what baptism is, but baptism, to understand it biblically, it's not sprinkling, it's not a pouring. It's a complete immersion or submersion. Was Israel on this occasion, were they submerged in water? Yeah, they were. Water on the sides, there was a cloud above them. Was there a cloud behind them? The pillar of cloud was there too. They were totally surrounded by water. That's a baptism of sorts. They're baptized into Moses, into their Redeemer. All right? And that's the point that Paul is making here. God's people, both Old and New Testament, have always been blessed. Baptized into Moses. Verse 3, he says, they all drank of the same spiritual drink. Where did Moses get water? From a rock. He provided for them. Where did they get their food? From heaven. Manna fell from heaven. God was always providing for them. They were a blessed people. And that is the same thing with us today. Israel entered into a special relationship with Moses. This baptism and all this provision. What's the parallel? Well, we're baptized into, not Moses, but we're baptized into Christ. Baptism for us also. And there's provision for us too. He provides for us in ways that we cannot fend for ourselves. And so that's the point I think that Paul's making. All right? And thus he says, his point is, now in one respect, I want you to be like Israel. Again, the verses that will follow, he says, don't do these things. They were guilty of these sins. Don't do that. But on these early verses, Israel enjoyed a relationship with their Redeemer, and you need to have such with your Redeemer, which of course is Christ. So this one brief mention in 1 Corinthians 10 is based upon this story we've been studying, which is the baptism, if you will, at the Red Sea. All right. Now finally, let's look at this. And this is the last question. We won't get this covered all tonight. We'll have to complete this on Sunday morning, the Lord willing, before we get to the next story. But I've asked you to compare Moses and Jesus as redeemers. This was sort of a little research question. In some ways, and in many ways, Moses serves as a type of Christ as a redeemer. Not that Christ is dependent upon Moses, that's not what I'm saying. But some of the things that Moses did, how Moses provided for the people, is an Old Testament type of what Christ is for us today. So the redemption redemption He brought for Israel can be comparable to the redemption Christ offers us in the New Testament. So I just prepared two little charts here. Some of the things that we can see, what to finish this up on Sunday. In the question, I've got you cited to Hebrews, the third chapter, which we'll get to that and nurse the first bell already. Where's Dennis? He rang the bell too early. It's his fault. Okay, we'll have to stop here. We'll complete this question Sunday morning, question 16 on page 22, and then start.